Many corrupt and evil kings came from that line. But there were two kings in particular, two Davidic kings who were noted for their righteousness, that they got something right. They were the kings Hezekiah and Josiah. And do you know what each of those kings had in common? Both of them, you can read about this in 2 Chronicles chapter 30 and 35, I think it is. Both Hezekiah and Josiah cleansed the temple, and they presided over great Passover feasts. So when we read in John chapter 2 that Jesus has come and he's cleansed the temple, here he is. He is the new, he is the true Passover, true Davidic king. Now again, if we had been reading John's gospel from the beginning, we would have seen this already. In his conversation with Nathanael, when he called Nathanael to be his disciple, Nathanael responds in John chapter 1, verse 49. He says, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." This is Jesus, the new and true Davidic king. Now again, I am fascinated by how John's account of this differs from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In the first three gospels, they all quote Jesus quoting the Old Testament, as does John. But the passages they quote are different. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have Jesus quoting from one of the prophets, Isaiah 56 and Jeremiah chapter 7. "My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." But John does not quote from the prophets. Where does he quote from? He quotes from the Psalms, and not just any psalm, a Davidic psalm, a psalm of David. He quotes from Psalm 69, verse 9, which is the prayer of a righteous sufferer. And you'll see, Psalm 69:9 says, "For zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you, God, have fallen on me." Now, do you notice what John did to that verse? He changed it a little bit, didn't he? You'll notice that he changed the verb tense. Psalm 69 says, "Zeal for your house has consumed me." John says, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Why the change? The moment when Jesus is going to be consumed is not there at the temple. It's at the end of his life where he is consumed on the cross. Do you remember what the sign says above Jesus on the cross? "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." This is the new and true Davidic king. Now, what does this teach us about worship? Jesus was filled with zeal. And true worship, friends, for you and I as well, involves being zealous for God. It means living and perhaps even dying for the honor of God's name. Again, I love how John Stott puts it. I've been reading him a bit lately, so you're going to get some of John. Whoops, did I miss this? I'm going to go back here. I guess I didn't put it in. Here it goes. Stott says this: "If therefore God desires every knee to bow to Jesus and every tongue to confess him, so should we. We should be jealous for the honor of his name, troubled when it remains unknown, hurt when his name is ignored, indignant when it is blasphemed, and all the time anxious and determined that it shall be given the honor and glory which are due to it. The highest of all missionary motives," he says, "is neither obedience to the Great Commission, as important as that is, nor love for sinners who are alienated and perishing, strong as that incentive is, especially when we contemplate the wrath of God. But rather," he says, "zeal, burning and passionate zeal for the glory of Jesus Christ." Now, John Stott applies zeal to the issue of evangelism, but we could apply it to anything. The zeal for God's name that Jesus showed in the temple courts is what true worship is all about in every area of our lives. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, that great chapter, where he starts out saying, you know, "In view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as living sacrifices. This is your true worship." He goes on in verse 11 of that chapter to say, "Do not be slothful in zeal." Don't Don't be lazy in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. You say that with me? I'll feed you the lines. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. All together, the whole thing, ready? Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. That's worship. The zeal for God's honor. Now I want to ask you for a moment. Is your worship of God more zealous or more slothful? Could you be described as fervent in your devotion for God? Are you energetic and enthusiastic in your worship, or when it comes to worship, are you more laid back and casual? Now, I'm not asking about your personality, whether you're an extrovert or an introvert. I'm asking you to do some heart work here, to evaluate yourself. Hopefully you can see that by worship, I'm not just talking about what happens here on Sunday. But I do think our attitude towards corporate worship may be an indicator of a larger issue. If you're a visitor right now, you can just check out for the next moment. If this is your church, I want to ask you some questions. Be honest with yourself. What is your approach to these times that we have together? Do you come ready to go hard after God with your spiritual family? Are you committed to being here, not just when it's convenient? Think about those summer days where it's warm outside and you've been at the beach all day long and, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock's rolling around. Do you have a commitment to come and worship? This is serious business. Do you see the time of worship through music and song as a time to honor God with the fruit of your lips and a heart that's devoted to him? Or do you see it as a time to enjoy your coffee when it's not your favorite song? I got to say, I'm flabbergasted sometimes when I'm leading worship up here and I look out and there's people just sipping their coffee, enjoying it. Guys, this is the worship of the living God. On the other hand, I am so encouraged when I hear people who are visiting and sometimes they say, man, your church really sings. It's like they believe this stuff. It's like, yes, we do. Do you fight to stay engaged with the teaching of God's word, doing the hard work of trying to apply what's being taught to your own life? Or are you just easily distracted until the next funny illustration is used? Worship is about zeal and going hard after God. Lastly, Jesus is the true and new temple. Again, John has already prepared the ground for us in chapter 1 when Jesus has been prepared to two precursors of the temple. You remember John 1, verse 14, the Word, who he's already told us, is God. This Word is Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us, or more literally, tabernacled among us. The tabernacle was the beta version, if you will, of the temple. It was the temple that was portable, that you could move around. It would fit in this room. It's a tent, concentric circles. So Jesus has already been compared to the tabernacle. And in John 1:51, he's having that conversation with Nathanael again. And he says to Nathanael, you shall see the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. He's the Son of Man. What's he saying? He's making a connection between what happened to Jacob. Do you remember in Genesis chapter 28, Jacob got in a fight with his brother Esau and he's running away to his uncle Laban in another country. And along the way, he stops in a little town of Luz and he lays down for the night and takes a dream. And in his dream, he sees, it's not a ladder that he saw. He sees a stairway. It's a temple. It's a ziggurat. It's an ancient temple. Looked like a pyramid with steps going up the sides. And he sees angels descending and ascending upon those steps. It was the intersection between heaven and earth. And when he wakes up, what does Jacob say? He said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. And he renames that town Bethel, which of course means house of God. And Jesus says, you shall see angels descending and ascending on the Son of Man. I am the house of God, he's saying. So when we get to John chapter 2, we're going over ground he's already plowed. Look at verse 18 again. The Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things, for cleansing the temple?" Jesus answered, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up." And the Jews said to him, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But he was talking about the temple of his body. Now, we need to get a handle on the stunning nature of the place that they were in. This was Herod's temple. Let's back up and get a little review of history of the temple. After the tabernacle, the first temple was built by David's son Solomon, roughly 1000 BC, 950 BC, somewhere in there. This temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. After that, another 100 years or so goes by, and Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah come along and they restore and rebuild this temple. It's just a shadow of its former glory. That temple was destroyed again in 168 BC by the tyrant Antiochus Epiphanes, who not only destroyed the temple, just to rub it in, he sacrificed a pig on the altar. Bad guy. That didn't go over well with the Jews. Now, Herod comes along, King Herod, not a Jew, hated by the Jews. He's a puppet king of the Romans, probably to curry favor with the Jews. He decides to completely overhaul the temple and rebuild this thing the right way. I want to show you some pictures of this temple. Remodel, obviously, models of the temple. This is the Temple Mount. The temple, obviously, the temple itself right in the middle, but the whole thing was referred to as the temple complex. And in that broad courtyard that Herod had made, he created that huge temple courts by building these massive retaining walls. And that courtyard in the middle is about 6 football fields in area. It's huge. Give you a better shot of it. You can see just outside those temple, there's a little railing. Can you see that, the railing on either side here? That was to separate. I might even have a little pointer here, do I? Oh, look at that. You see that little railing right here? This is called the wall of separation that separated the court of the Gentiles from the temple proper. This is obviously the temple. This was called the court of women. And this is where some of the sacrifices would be offered. And inside these doors was the holy place. And behind a curtain there was, at the center of that, was the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place. But out here in the court of the Gentiles, this is as far as non-Jews could come, and that's where the animals were being sold. But this place was massive. To get a handle on this, it had been 46 years in building this when the story is told here. They had 18,000 men working full-time for 46 years to build this. Why that many? Some of those stones are 70 tons. Can you imagine trying to build something that day without cranes or anything? Let me show you. This is during Steve and I went to Israel. You can see behind this little tour guide, that whole thing is one massive stone. This is underneath some archaeological place where they see some of the foundation stones. Here, you can see Steve with his backpack on. But I was trying to get a sense in this little place of how large those stones were. And just as an aside, we had such a fun trip together. But Steve comes across as a pretty secure guy. But he'd always say, "You know, Mike, I'm really missing Donna. Can you just give me a hug?" So every once in a while, I'd just give him a big hug there. And, you know, there we are. So we had a good, yeah. Anyhow. Wow. So there's the temple. Big deal. It is impossible to overstate the significance of the temple to Jews. It was not just a sacred place to pray and do sacrifices and do their religious duty. No, if this church burnt down, we could easily just, you know, if we built it over there, it would be no problem. But for the Jews, this spot was sacred. I want to show you something. This is by a Jewish scholar, ancient Jewish scholar, who said the exact location of the altar is extremely precise and it can never be changed. And it is a universally accepted tradition that the place on which David and Solomon built the altar, on the site of the threshing floor of Araunah, is the same spot upon which our father Abraham bound Isaac. And this very same site where Adam, the first man, brought his offering. And from this spot, he himself was created. For our sages teach us that man was created from the very place that brings about his atonement. Another Roman era midrash says this: as the navel is set in the center of the human body, I love illustrations that have to do with belly buttons. It's great. So is the land of Israel the navel of the world, situated in the center of the world, and Jerusalem in the center of the land of Israel, and the sanctuary in the center of Jerusalem, and the holy place in the center of the sanctuary, and the ark in the center of the holy place, and the foundation stone before the holy place, because from it the world was founded. They believe that this actual, what they call the foundation stone, was where creation began. Now, are you starting to understand the importance of this place where God had acted so many times through history and had caused his presence and glory to dwell? Can you see how radical and outrageous it would have been for Jesus to come along and say, I'm the new temple? Wow. What sign will you give, they say? Destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. This is what he came to do. And it's by virtue of his sacrificial death and resurrection that Jesus stands at the center of all human history. He's not just a good teacher. He's not just a miracle worker or a revolutionary. He is the Lord. And Jesus will not be relegated to the periphery. You see, true worship, we learn here, is nothing less than a radical reorientation of our whole lives around Jesus, the crucified and risen one. All understandings of Jesus that don't take into account the significance of his death and resurrection are, in the end, misunderstandings of Jesus. And so too, for any of our lives that are not oriented around this person of Jesus and his death and resurrection, are in the end misoriented lives. I want to ask you, what gives your life meaning? Is it your family? Your friendships? Your hobby? Your work? What is your life centered on? This passage challenges us to make Jesus, the new covenant temple, the center of our worship, the way we deal with our failure and shame, the one to whom we conform the rhythms of our life to. Now, I want you to notice, I'm almost done, but Jesus is not afraid to step on toes or disrupt that which has become sacred. Perhaps some of you were uncomfortable the last couple of weeks with the fact that we dealt with the issues of race and abortion in church. Perhaps it felt too personal, too sacred to make pronouncements about. If so, we need to see Jesus unabashedly treading on sacred ground, turning over tables. Now, some of us may have the attitude, Jesus, I will give you Sundays, but stay away, don't intrude on my finances. Or, you know, you're invited, Jesus, to speak about work ethics to me, but don't speak into my bedroom ethics. You're welcome to fill in the blank, this part of my life, but this part's mine. If that's you, this passage calls us to repent. You see, Jesus' zeal for honor, Jesus' zeal for God's honor extends to another house as well. It extends to your house. In John 14:23, we read, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. People who are older in the room may remember pastor by the name of Bob Munger. He wrote a little pamphlet called My Heart, Christ's Home. And it used to be read quite a bit. If you don't never read it, I encourage you. You can find it online and read it in less than 10 minutes. But it's an analogy that Munger uses about our heart being Christ's home and Christ coming in and being shown around the house. First, he goes into the library, which is a metaphor for our mind and the things that we look at and the images we keep in our mind and the things that we read. And Jesus comes in and he's just appalled by what's on the bookshelves. And he says, okay, all these have to go. And he, you know, clears the bookshelves and he refills them with scriptures about himself. And he puts a big picture of himself on the wall and he says, focus on this. Next, they go to the dining room and then the living room and the work room and the rec room. You get the picture. Jesus restructures everything in the house. The last place that they go is the hall closet. Let me read just a bit of it to you. It says, there's just one more matter that I might share with you, Munger writes. One day I found him, Jesus, waiting for me at the door, and a resting look was in his eye. As I entered, he said to me, there's a peculiar odor in the house. There's something that's dead around here. It's upstairs. I think it's in the hall closet. As soon as he said this, I knew what he was talking about. Yes, there was a small closet up there on the landing, just a few square feet. And in that closet, behind lock and key, I had one or two little personal things that I did not want anyone to know about and certainly did not want Christ to see them. I knew they were dead and rotting things left over from the old life, and yet I loved them and I wanted them for myself. And I was afraid to admit that they were there. Reluctantly, I went up to Jesus. And As we mounted the stairs, the odor became stronger and stronger. And he pointed at the door. It's in there, some dead thing. I was angry. That's the only way I can put it. I had given him access to the library, the dining room, the living room, the workroom, the playroom. And now he was asking me for a little 2x4 closet. And I said to myself, this is too much. I'm not ready to give him the key. Well, he said, reading my thoughts, if you think I'm going to stay up here on the second floor with this odor, you are mistaken. I'll take my bed out on the back porch. I'm certainly not going to put up with that. Then I saw him start down the stairs. Now, when you have come to know and love Christ, the worst thing that can happen is to sense the withdrawal of his fellowship. I had to surrender. I'll give you the key, I said sadly, but you'll have to open the closet and clean it out. I haven't the strength for it. I know, he said. I know you haven't. Just give me the key. Just authorize me to take care of the closet, and I will. So with trembling fingers, I passed the key to him. He took it from my hand and walked over to the door. He opened, entered it, took out all the putrefying stuff that was rotting there, and threw it away. The closet, he cleaned the closet, painted it, fixed it up, doing all of this in a moment's time. Oh, what victory and release to have that dead thing out of my life. To know Jesus, you have to understand this. That is what Jesus came for. That's what he died for. It's what he rose for. Have you seen a pattern in what we're talking about today? Jesus is the true and new Passover lamb, sacrificed for the sins of the world. Jesus is the new and true Davidic king, who because of his zeal for God was consumed on the cross. And Jesus is the true and new temple who was destroyed and yet was raised again. You see, to know Jesus, we must know him as the one who came to die and rise again that we might live and worship him, who with the Father and the Spirit demand and invite us to center our lives around him. That's what this table is about that we're going to come to. It's a remembrance of this Lamb, this King, this temple, that he gave himself willingly for us and for our salvation. If you trust in him, this table is for you. Look at verse 22 before we finish. It says, when therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture, the word that he had spoken. That's what all this comes down to. Do you believe it? Will you center your life on this? If you do, come and with joy celebrate the feast, the Passover, the true Passover feast. If that's not you, if you're just here visiting or not sure, just watch the rest of us as we come and admit that we need Jesus, we need a Savior. Let's worship the risen, the living Christ who invites us to meet with him and commune with him now. Prayer teams are going to be available as they always are as we come to the table.